All right. Thank you for joining me, everyone. Charles Moskowitz. Doing the program Monday through Friday, 12 noon to 1 or 2, depending, this being the internet, I could really stay on or not as long as I choose, which is an amazing technology when they let you do it. let's see. Today I have as guests, Robert Spencer will be up with us at 12 noon Eastern Standard Time. And Robert is the author of the best-selling book, The History of Jihad, The Palestinian Delusion, and Did Mohammed Exist, which is his latest book. He led seminars for the FBI, the U.S. Central Command, U.S. Army Command, and General Staff College, Asymmetric Warfare Group, and a Joint Terrorism Task Force. His newest book, Did Mohammed Exist? An Inquiry into Islam's Obscure Origins. He'll be joining me at 12 noon, and then at 2 p.m., Black activist will be joining me, Christopher Arps, who will be discussing the issue of the Supreme Court ruling for voter integrity. The decision aligns with the project he's affiliated with, that being Project 21. And he wants to talk about ballot harvesting and out-of-precinct voting and other practices that were basically discouraged by, in this case, Georgia, but I believe almost 20 states, including numbers of so-called blue states, who are now saying that this practice of voter harvesting is inherently corrupt. And in that sense, they're in agreement with the Carter Center and with other studies. And that absentee ballots that are not confirmed by signature is something that the states have a right to do, but it gets to a more fundamental constitutional issue. And of course, we're thinking about the Constitution right now because, well, we should be, because it's July 4th, the 4th of July being the celebration of American Declaration of Independence in 1776. And so we can take a pause and think about what that's about. And that led to the ratification of the U.S. Constitution about 15 years later, and that the Constitution, Article 2, Section 2, essentially leaves up to the states the responsibility to regulate the election every 2 years that is held, besides state elections, the federal election, which is held every 2 years for both the state and the rep and Senate, and every 4 years for the president. And that that is a responsibility of the states. Obviously, if the state is putting in laws that violate the constitutional rights of a particular group of people or person, then that can be challenged to the Supreme Court. But other than that, the state has a right to regulate across the board and equally election law. And that includes laws against practices like voter harvesting and the ability of precincts and communities to manage their electoral lists and remove from that list names of people who have either passed away or have moved out of state or maybe registered in more than one jurisdiction or state. And that they have a right to examine those lists, audit those lists, and remove the names of people who don't comport to that definition, the definition of a citizen who resides in that state. And the reason why states have that right and assume that right, and that's obviously any state, regardless of whether it's Democratic or Republican, red or blue, and all of that, is because it is the responsibility of the respective states to make sure that there's no voter suppression. And what is voter suppression? When does voter suppression happen? Voter suppression happens when a false vote is cast. Every time a false vote is cast, the legitimate vote of the citizen is suppressed. If you vote for candidate X and then a false vote is cast, which in other words, it's a vote cast from the grave or cast from an unregistered person from out of state who may not exist, and that vote is cast for candidate Y, then your vote is canceled. essentially. And as such, your vote is suppressed. So the states have a responsibility to ensure that their citizens' votes are not suppressed. And the Supreme Court has upheld that position, which is a good thing for our republic with its democratic principles. Okay, so the program is live. Let me go live on all of the affiliates here. And I'm on many. So thank you for joining me, everyone who's all the affiliates. We're live on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, and about five other venues. And in the near future, I'm working with a technology expert. I will be going live with video and audio on all of these venues, and hopefully more as I expand the network. And I think that's going to help drive audience. It's going to bring people in. I'm going to give a facility by which, first of all, anyone can call into the program and comment on any issue they choose to. And let me just give out the number for that. I'm going to be promoting this number. The number is 617-396-4958. That number again, 617-396-4958. You are welcome to join the program as I develop this amazing online audience live Monday through Friday, 12 noon and beyond. And I do have coming up a guest at 12 noon, that being author Robert Spencer. We're going to be talking about his new book. Let me just see here, which is called Did Muhammad Exist? An Inquiry into Islam's Obscure Origins. And then at 2 o'clock, we'll be joined by Christopher Arps, who is an activist with the Black Leadership Network Project 21. And he wants to talk about the decision by the Supreme Court, which basically recognizes the state's rights to regulate things like anything connected to voting, but particularly voter harvesting and out-of-precinct voting. So those two guests are scheduled to come on with me. In the meantime, you are welcome to join the program, 617-396-4958. Let's keep the conversation in the bounds of community propriety here. I'm a veteran radio host. I know what that means. I think everyone listening knows what that means. Please do that. And also, let's avoid the forbidden topics, frankly, for YouTube, because otherwise I'm going to have to take it off YouTube. And one of those forbidden topics, frankly, is the election of 2020. You're not allowed to criticize it. Let me just say this about that, if I may. And I'm not getting into anything forbidden on YouTube here, because I'm not questioning the legitimacy of that election. I know you're not allowed to do that, at least not on YouTube. But I want to make one point that I think, you know, it's hard to know exactly what lies within the purview of that which is permitted by YouTube particularly, but big tech generally. So I'm going to guess that this is okay, because I'm doing a general political criticism here. And that is the fact that those who do question, and I'm not saying I'm one of them right now, let's be clear, at least not for YouTube, but those who do question the legitimacy of the election are being criminalized. They're being called terrorists, insurrectionists, white supremacists, all kinds of other ridiculous names, and basically denounced and banned, as I'm demonstrating right now on YouTube. You can't discuss this in every way possible, which I think is completely un-American, because it is opinion. And, you know, it's not calling for an overthrow of the government. It's not calling for violence. It's simply an opinion based upon any election. People have a right to express, I would suggest, at least under our constitutional system, they have a right, and they ought to continue to have a right, to express opinions such as that and back it up and be prepared to discuss it and present their evidence and do so in a timely and cogent and coherent manner. If they can't do that, then sure, media can say, forget it, this is whack job stuff. I would suggest that that is being done and can be done coherently. It's not whack job. It's stuff that can be presented. And thus, it is legitimate discourse. It's legitimate political opinion. And the reason I'm mentioning now the trend toward criminalizing that opinion, and I say literally because the Attorney General of the United States, Merrick Garland, who was very proud of the fact that the Department of Justice, operating through the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security, have done a national sweep where they've arrested hundreds of people for entering the US Capitol on January 6th, which is a trespassing charge. I'm not here to defend it, but it's not a major crime, frankly, in my opinion, and have put a lot of these people in detention in a prison facility. And in many cases, they are being held, isolation. They're being, isolated, and in some cases, beaten and tortured. And they're not yet facing their accuser. They're not yet facing charges. I wonder where that kind of power comes from, frankly, in the U.S. government. It seems to me that it might be a relationship between that and the USA Patriot Act, or even so-called anti-terrorist legislation that was debated in the 90s in the aftermath of the Oklahoma City bombing, that basically the government is allowed to hold American citizens indefinitely almost without registering charges and without allowing them to face their accuser and in secret. All right, I don't want to go too far into that, but it's a subject that I've researched in the past. The point I'm making here is that that opinion is being used by the FBI and by various agencies to buttress their case that these people are involved in criminality, that they had supported the position that questioned the legitimacy of the election, that they had attended a Stop the Steal rally or whatever. These things are all free speech. And that these things are being employed in a manner that would lead toward these opinions being criminalized at worst, certainly weaponized at best. And I juxtapose that with the fact that the idea that the 2016 election of Donald Trump was not legitimate, according to many, was a charge that was made all the time, every day, by various people, the liberal-leaning people and the Democratic Party apparatus, and Hillary Clinton, who made this charge publicly many times, and all the fashionable people in Hollywood, actors and actresses and musicians, that the election was not legitimate. Trump is not my president. He's an illegitimate leader. They use the word illegitimate. That basically what they were saying was that Trump had stolen the election. And the wacky conspiracy theory to back that up, and it's probably the biggest conspiracy theory that, at least at the scale of it, that I've seen come down the pike in my lifetime, was that Donald Trump was spying for Russia, and that as such, he was, quote, colluding with Russia and with Vladimir Putin to steal the election. And that Vladimir Putin essentially put Trump in power and that it was a stolen election. This was the thesis that we heard about every single day from the minute he was elected right up till, well, January 6th, when the narrative changed of 2021. It was the establishment position. It was the you know, the oligarch position. It was the what President Trump called the deep state position. You had people who were operating within the national security agencies, the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, the DSA, who advocated this and did so publicly. I would point to particularly former CIA Director Brennan, former FBI Director Comey. You know, these people were openly claiming variations of this theme, that, that Donald Trump was spying for Russia and that he had been put in power by the Russians because of a collusion. And not only were they saying this, and that this was in all the mainstream media, all the big tech companies that are now censoring anyone who suggests that there might have been a problem with 2020. But there was no censorship for that. There was promotion of it constantly. Oh, we never heard the end of it with these long, laborious commentaries and articles. And it was just in the news every day, and the Sunday pundits would go on and on. Then, and then, of course, they got their Mueller committee, which cost the taxpayers upwards of $40 million. So you had taxpayers paying for this conspiracy. And the Mueller group with their brown shirts went out and arrested and put in prison people like Paul Manafort, this elderly man who had done things that had nothing to do with Trump. He was persecuted because he was briefly a campaign manager for Trump. And as a, you know, working with foreign countries, he did nothing apparently any different than Podesta, the head of the Clinton campaign. Podesta, according to his email release, had engaged in, and his brother had engaged in similar relations with foreign powers. And he had done a lot of other stuff, which is forbidden to talk about, but that's that's another subject. And the point is that this Mueller group, they pulled, you know, Roger Stone off the street, you know, showed up at his door. He's like never been charged with a crime. He's in his late 70s. His wife is deaf. They're banging the door down. CNN is out in the front lawn filming it. Oh, everybody applauded. Oh, good. This is wonderful. Just like they recently applauded when they took President Trump's accountant away in handcuffs, you know, for accepting a benefit, you know, from the Trump from the Trump organization. I mean, I think that they gave him a car or something like that. They claimed he didn't pay taxes. Never mind that Hunter Biden was doing huge billion-dollar deals with foreign governments and by siphoning the money to the family. That's not to be discussed. It's very, you know, in other words, the broad possession I'm making here is that this is a two-tiered system. But getting back, I mean, the conspiracy theory that Trump had, his election was illegitimate, was a mainstream theory that we heard over and over and over, and that taxpayers spent billions of dollars. And in the process, we damaged our system of justice by singling people out for minor alleged crimes, process crimes, things that they had done that had nothing to do with anything, but they were just being prosecuted because they of their association with President Trump, and put in like solitary confinement and imprisoned. That's the kind of stuff that shouldn't happen in this country. That's the kind of stuff that happens in Nazi socialist Germany or Soviet socialist Russia. You know, it's not really the way we do things, but the fact that it did happen and that it was so accepted by and even applauded by the mainstream liberal media and by mainstream liberals who are just drooling over it, is something that speaks very poorly for the future of freedom. And I say this at a time when we are celebrating the 4th of July, the Independence Day, and we're reflecting on what that should mean for us. It's under siege. Anyway, my guest is coming up shortly, so... by the way, my book is available. All my books are available at Amazon Books. The Satanic Conspiracy. Apparently, it's selling fairly well. I've been doing interviews. The Satanic Conspiracy, Charles Moskowitz. Check it out. It's on. It's available at Amazon Books, as are all of my books. And let me give out the phone number. You're welcome to join the conversation. I've got Robert Spencer coming up at the top of the hour. 617-396-4958 is the number. Please keep it within the bounds of community standards. But if you call that number, you will be heard and you will be able to converse with yours truly and with my guest, Robert Spencer, coming up in a couple of minutes. That number again, 617-396-4958, 617-396-4958. And let me just do a little prepping for Robert Spencer. His book is, it's called, let me just see here from his, Did Muhammad Exist? He's also the best-selling author of The History of Jihad, The Palestinian Delusion. It says here that his press release, Radical Islam is Rising Under Joe Biden. I wonder if he's going to want to comment on this most recent event in Boston, where I am, that being the Moors, which is a group that no one's ever heard of, being stopped on Route 128, fully armed, in military garb. 11 men are now being questioned as I speak in court. There's not a lot known about them, but they do seem, it does seem to, apparently they are Islamic and they are, I don't know, maybe they're affiliated with kind of the Nation of Islam type of thing. I don't know. But Robert Spencer may have some information on that. He's asked the question, are jihadis dying for a fiction? Everything you thought you knew about Islam is about to change. Is there any sound historical evidence that the Prophet of Islam actually existed? Or is the entire story of Muhammad a fable? It's a question that few have thought or dared to ask. And by the way, I'm not bringing this up because I'm anti-Muslim at all. I'm simply looking at the history here. I mean, I would bring up, if I had a guest who wanted to come on and tell me that Jesus didn't exist or Moses didn't exist, I would discuss that as well. And that wouldn't make me anti-Christian or anti-Jewish. It's just, I'm interested in history. I like to look at what is concrete in history, as opposed to what might have been created by powers as part of a revision. And by the way, revisionist history is a thing. It's, your people, I mean, the 1619 Project is a good example of that. And that's now being promoted through critical race theory by the National Education Association, who wants their teachers to teach this. It is revisionism. It's all right, here we go. And I guess we have Robert, thanks for joining me.
Happy to be.
Let me just get your sound up there a little bit better.
Okay.
There you are. All right, Robert Spencer is here. He is the best-selling author of The History of Jihad, The Palestinian Delusion, and his latest book, Did Muhammad Exist? Robert, you've counseled the U.S. Army. You've been involved in anti-terrorism training. You've got a very good and distinguished background as a scholar on Islam, a subject that you've spent 20 years of your life studying and writing about and researching. And this book is startling. Did Muhammad exist? I guess that I'll just start right from there. Did Muhammad exist?
There may have been somebody named Muhammad Charles, but he was not anything like the prophet of Islam that we hear about from Islamic traditions. The main thing is that the Islamic traditions that tell us about Muhammad's words and deeds mostly come from 200 years after Muhammad is supposed to have lived. And the earliest ones from about 125 years after. There is no record of him before that, not even mentions in any specific way, a couple of scattered mentions of the name here and there. But even then, it's not clear in each of those circumstances whether they're actually talking about the Prophet of Islam or not, for various reasons.
Well, I let me just push back a little bit here in that the alleged or real biography of Muhammad occurred in the 7th century, which is not ancient times. This is modern times. This is, you know, Middle Ages almost. And I think that it would be very difficult to simply manufacture the existence of this particular figure. I mean, I certainly understand that questions of his communicating with the angel Gabriel, those are matters of faith. But the, you know, the actual existence of a figure, I mean, I would think that would be hard to simply make up.
Well, I'll tell you, Charles, it's a very good point, but the situation is this. He's supposed to have died in 632, and the Arabs started to conquer the Middle East, North Africa, Persia, going into India within right after he died in 632. And within 100 years after his death in 732, they had this massive empire stretching from Spain all the way across North Africa and the Middle East through Iran and into India.
Right.
Now, ordinarily, we think of this as having been inspired by him, that he taught that the Muslims should wage war against unbelievers. That's in the Quran. And therefore, they did it and obeyed him and conquered all this territory. However, if you look at the first 60 years after he's supposed to have lived, that is from the 630s to the 690s, the conquests undeniably happen. But nobody mentions Muhammad or Islam or the Quran. The conquered people, in several cases, write about the conquerors. They never even call them Muslims. They'd give no hint that they had a new religion or a new prophet or a new holy book.
So you might say that the conquerors, the Arabians coming out of the Arabian Peninsula, who subdued, as you point out, over in the course of 100 years, Christian North Africa, Palestine, Syria, parts of Turkey, parts of Asia Minor, Iran, right up to India, that they were simply, I mean, you know, they might have needed a religion or a kind of an organized body of belief to consolidate their empire. So they developed this myth, which would put this conquest into a method of justification and a cohesion. Is that right?
That's exactly it. In those days, that was how an empire was held together. There weren't parliaments, there weren't constitutions. There was a common religion. The Byzantine Empire was one of the great powers of the day, the Eastern Roman Empire, and it was Christian. And being Christian was an integral part of being a Byzantine citizen, such that a lot of non-Christians left the empire because they suffered discrimination in there. Right. In the Persian Empire, the other great power was Zoroastrian, same thing there. It was the religion that was considered to be the glue that held the empire together. So the Arabs, once they amassed their empire, needed a religion in order to hold their empire together. And since it was made by warriors, the religion that is, it was martial, expansionist, aggressive, and violent, because those are the kinds of qualities that the people who developed it wanted to inculcate in the people.
Well, I mean, you could to a certain extent, and I want to be careful here, say similar things about Christianity, and that after the Emperor Constantine accepted Christianity as the state religion of the Roman Empire, he held the Council of Nicaea and then the Council of Trent, which came a little later, and several other councils, which basically formulated what that meant. You know, they created Constantinian Christianity, which sort of established certain principles, and they worked out certain contradictions and developed a coherent faith. And that, you know, there's always a political element. I mean, the Protestant Reformation created state Christian churches where the, you know, instead of one centralized in Rome, Judaism probably has that aspect as well. You know, so I think that it's safe to say that, I mean, even the word religion comes from the Latin religio, which means organized. It is an organized method by which there can be a state-sponsored means of worship.
So, oh, no doubt.
Yeah. So Islam is no different in that regard, and that they did venerate this particular prophet who, I think you can assume there was somebody in Arabia who probably was some kind of a mystic that was Muhammad. But the actual agenda, the qualities, the beliefs were probably put there when they developed the Quran, and that came much later.
Excuse me, but yeah, just one example of what I mean by this. It's a very strange omission, a very strange absence. Take, for example, the conquest of Jerusalem, which happened around the year 637. And nobody denies that the Arabs came out of Arabia and conquered Jerusalem.
Right.
There's a famous story of Sophronius, the patriarch of Jerusalem, the head of the church in Jerusalem. He was essentially the governing authority there at the time because the Byzantine power was very weak in that area. He is supposed to, according to this story, have welcomed the Caliph Umar, the leader of the Muslims, into the city and walked around the city with him, showing him the sites. And then when they got to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the church that is, according to tradition, built on the site where Christ rose from the dead, the patriarch told the Caliph, why don't you go in, invited him to go in and pray inside. And the Caliph Umar refused, saying, I want to leave this church for you Christians. If I go in and pray, my followers will claim it for a mosque. This story is told to this day as an example of Islamic tolerance and magnanimity.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is quite different. That story comes from the 800s, 200 years after the events that it describes are supposed to have happened. But we actually have quite a lot of writings of Sophronius, and quite a lot of those writings are deeply preoccupied with the conquest by the Arabs. He speaks about the conquerors. He speaks about the fact that he's trying to understand, as a Christian prelate, how it is that this conquest could have happened. He's trying to understand, you know, is it because we sinned against God or things of this kind? And he speaks a great deal about the conquerors. He says that they burn down churches and they do various other things, but he never mentions Umar. He never tells that story. He never calls them Muslims. He never says they have a new religion. He never mentions Muhammad. He never mentions the Quran. And yet it's very clear from what he does talk about that he was in extensive communication with the conquerors, that he was trying to understand them and understand what they were all about. And they never seem to have mentioned anything about this new religion that is supposed to have inspired this conquest.
And Umar, of course, would go down as the successor to Muhammad. So there was like a political peace, yes, there. And then eventually there would be a schism, which resulted in the development of the Sunni and the Shiites, in that there was an argument over the third generation succession. According to Jewish legend, Umar was, you know, he was very tolerant toward the Jews. I mean, you know, that the Byzantines were not pro-Jewish, especially after there had been an attempt at liberating Palestine backed by the Persian Sassanids. They came back in and they started to, you know, it was very brutal toward the Jews. 15 years later, in comes Umar after the Battle of Yarmouk, and he, for the first time, allowed Jews to go back to Jerusalem. They had been banned by the Byzantines for hundreds of years. And according to some, the Dome of the Rock at the Temple Mount is actually a synagogue because it doesn't comport to the conventional mosque. And some of the writings on it have been translated to indicate that it might have been Judaic in nature. So, you know, there are different, I think there are different understandings of his role. He would eventually be assassinated. And
well, everything you're saying is 9th century stories. None of those stories are contemporary. And so even the existence of Umar is also in question in the sense that there really isn't any contemporary evidence that any such person existed. And so it may be that the stories that you're recounting are also part of this legend that was constructed. It's interesting to note that there would be a reason. A lot of times it was the conquered people themselves who constructed these stories about Muslim rulers being tolerant toward them because they wanted to use them to deal with the Muslims that they were dealing with in their own day. For example, there's the famous St. Catherine's Monastery in Egypt that goes back to the times before Islam. And they have in that monastery a letter supposedly written by Muhammad himself. And in his handwriting, that is, it's supposed to be the actual letter that he wrote granting the right to exist to this monastery.
Right.
And the monks there have hauled that out over the ages to various jihadis who come to the monastery and say, we're taking this over and all you monks have to clear out. And they show them this letter and say, look, Muhammad says we can stay here. And it's a great idea, really, and it served them well. But here again, there's no evidence that that letter existed before the 9th century. And so it does seem as if all of this was elaborated for various reasons in the 9th century. You go back to the 7th century, and we have the Arab conquests, mm-hmm. and we have writings by the non-Muslims like Sophronius and others, but there is a yawning absence of any mention of these people that are in the traditional Islamic account, not just Muhammad, but also Umar and those around him.
So, I mean, that makes sense to me that people who were living under the yoke of the Islamic conquerors or the Arab conquerors, such as Christians and Jews, that they might have developed some legends at the time in order for self-preservation, in order to continue and to justify their existence, and that history is written, you know, there are concrete elements of history, and then there's other things that are there for political reasons. I would even argue that some of the language that worked its way into the New Testament was put in there because of what was a civil war between the early Christians and the Jews. That's not favorable toward the Jews. And likewise, Jewish language was put into books like the Book of Jesus, which is not pro-Christian, hardly. And it was part of this kind of political conflict that was going on at the time. And that it exacerbated an agenda on each side against the other. So history has to be viewed in that context. To say, though, that someone didn't exist, I mean, I guess that if we're going to look at the historical record, I mean, people could say that Socrates didn't exist.
Right? Well, that may be
Aristotle.
Socrates, but I can tell you that there's just no contemporary evidence that Muhammad existed. Now, what that reflects on other historical figures, I think each case is different and has to be evaluated on its own merits. But I'll give you another piece of evidence in this. For one thing, a lot of Muslims like to point to a document called the Doctrina Jacobi, which dates from the year 634. Mm-hmm. And it speaks about a prophet who has arisen among the Arabs. And there are people say, see, that's Muhammad. But there are several problems with this identification. One is that the prophet in the Doctrina Jacobi is still alive and is leading the armies of the Muslims into Syria. Muhammad is supposed to have died, according to Islamic tradition, in 632 before the Muslims invaded Syria. So that's one problem. Second problem, he's not named, this prophet. And I readily grant you that there was a prophet among the Arabs and that his legend may have been incorporated into the later Muhammad legend, but this prophet is not named. Okay. And not only that, but the Doctrina Jacobi says that he's preaching the savior who is to come. Islam does not preach a savior who is to come. Islam is all about there's no God but Allah and Muhammad is his prophet. And Muhammad's not a savior, but he's already come. There are various savior figures, the Mahdi and so on, that come back at the end of the world, but that's not the central teaching of Islam as encapsulated in the confession of faith. There's no God but Allah and Muhammad is his prophet. And so the teaching doesn't correspond to Islam. The prophet is not named and the prophet is still alive when Muhammad is supposed to have been dead. So it seems like already we have some disconfirmation, not confirmation, of the Islamic story. And certainly we have no contemporary record of any of this, of the voluminous material that we get in the 9th century, tracking what Muhammad did practically every day. There's nobody even mentions that it exists in the 7th century. You know,
Ishara Sak, the author of The Life of Muhammad, translated by Guillaume in the 19th century.
I'm sorry, who? Oh yeah, Ibn Ishaq is 750 rather, but we don't even have Ibn Ishaq.
Okay.
Because Ibn Ishaq's book was lost. What we have is Ibn Hisham, who was in the 830s, and he copied out a massive portion of Ibn Ishaq. Mm-hmm. And added it to his own writing. But we don't know how much of it he changed. And see, this is the problem, okay, that we don't have any earlier evidence before the beginning of the 9th century for Muhammad. And so it's very hard to be sure that these things have any value before that. ordinarily, when you have oral tradition, you have some people mentioning things that pertain to the oral tradition. An example is in the New Testament, when the Acts of the Apostles quotes Jesus saying, "It is more blessed to give than to receive." If you read the four Gospels, that's not in there. It was an oral tradition that ends up in Acts, but wasn't recorded in the four Gospels. Now, that's the kind of thing you expect when you have stories circulating orally. But in all that time of the Arab conquests, you don't have Arabs saying, "As Muhammad said," and he quotes something. He's not even mentioned, which is a very glaring absence, a very strange omission.
Who actually created then the Hadith? And that, I know that came after the Quran, and that deals with some of the more bloodthirsty stuff that you find in there.
That's the 9th century material that I'm referring to.
Okay.
You take, for example, the Imam Bukhari. Bukhari is a Muslim scholar who lived in the 9th century, in the 800s, and he is, according to Islamic tradition, the collector of the most reliable, I'm just sorry, I just saw that my name's wrong on here.
Right.
I'm not the only one who uses this, and I am not John Spencer. Sorry about
That's
that.
That's typical. Don't worry about it. Everyone's up to that.
Yes. Anyway, Bukhari is the author of the most reliable collection of hadith. That is the one that Islamic scholars consider to be the most reliable. If the story's in Bukhari, it has the presumption of authenticity. Now, Bukhari lived in the 800s, and he's supposed to have gone around the Islamic world and collected 600,000 stories of Muhammad. And then he rejected 593,000 of those as inauthentic, as forgeries. And he published the other 7,000 in this massive, it's in English, it's a 9-volume set. And that's his Sahih Bukhari, his collection of hadith. Now, he determined that the 7,000 were authentic and the 593,000 were not authentic, not based on what they said, but based on the chain of transmitters, which is like a big game of telephone, like Charles told Robert, who told Joe, who told Bill. And if all those people are considered reliable, then the story is considered reliable. But he never considered the possibility that if a story could be forged, as they clearly were, as even he acknowledged, 593,000 of them were forged by various Islamic groups to support the positions they were taking, then they could have easily forged the chain of transmitters as well. And there's no basis for believing that the 7,000 that he picked have any greater historical value than the 593,000 that he rejected. They all are based, they all arise in the 9th century, and there's no trace of their existence before that.
And did he primarily work in the Arabian Peninsula, or was he all over the Arab world?
That's another thing, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was going to mention that and forgot. So thank you, Charles. The reality is he did not go into the Arabian Peninsula. He was working in Iraq and Syria,
okay,
and around that area. And another noteworthy aspect of this is that the earliest mosques don't face Mecca. There is a scholar, Dan Gibson, who recently actually went to the surviving mosques that come from the 7th century, and he found that, you know how every mosque has a mihrab, which is a little niche in the wall that points the way to Mecca, so that you can face Mecca when praying. But the earliest mosques don't face Mecca, they face Petra in southern Jordan.
Okay, that's interesting.
Not only do they face Petra in southern Jordan, but the Quran is not written in the Arabic dialect of Mecca, which is in southwestern Arabia. It's written in the dialect of southern Jordan, which is where Petra is.
Which was the major Nabataean center during Roman times. And
exactly,
a very obscure and unknown civilization that created this magnificent city that's been abandoned with these great buildings carved into the side of a hill. And, you know, people go there as tourists now. And not a lot is known about the Nabataeans. So that's interesting. That could have been the original religious orientation. You know, the idea of Mecca was perhaps a political thing, in that because the Arabians who left that area and conquered much of the Middle East, they wanted to legitimize their rule. So it brings us up to today, in that we're looking at a religious text that regardless of, whether or not Muhammad was the real McCoy or not, it has in it good things, but it also has this lingering element that seeks to conquer the world physically, and that presents Muhammad, especially in the later part of the Quran, as a military leader, and as a rather bloodthirsty one, I would add, who physically wanted to subdue the entire planet and create a one world government that would reflect the one God in heaven. And that anyone who rejected that or resisted that was viewed as living in a world of war, the Dar el-Ab, that would have to be subjected to conquest, either directly through military force, or if they can't do it at that point, through subversion and through lies and through undermining that culture until eventually the ultimate utopia. And it's very similar to the communist idea, I would add, and the Nazi idea. This isn't unique to Islam. Islam isn't even the worst of them, is to create a one world order where everyone is living in the Dar el-Islam, the world of Islam, and that the very word Islam in Arabic means to submit to God, as they say. And so it's that aspect of the doctrine that's troubling to me, for the same reason that I'm troubled by communism, Nazism, and any other attempt to create a one world order, whether it be the modern technocrats and oligarchs who want to do it through computers. However it happens, it is a satanic thing. I mean, in my new book, The Satanic Conspiracy, deals with this. It is anti-human, it's anti-nature, it's anti-freedom. It's trying to create this one world order. So, I mean, I hope that, Robert, your research can maybe begin to lead to a reform of that one aspect of Islam, not the whole religion, but just that one aspect that seeks to subdue the world.
Well, that would be nice. We'll see.
All right. Well,
I just wanted to pursue a historical inquiry because it's noteworthy that for centuries now, there have been historical investigations of Judaism and Christianity trying to determine the historical value of the Jewish and Christian scriptures, but there has never been that same kind of investigation in Islam, primarily because, of course, people are afraid. And we have to not bow to violent intimidation or the battle against the aggressive and violent ideology that you described just now is already lost because we're already giving them what they want out of fear. And so
they operate in a violent way, and you know, you have reason to be afraid.
Exactly.
You know, this is a real deal. And I would also add that Christianity and Judaism do not teach world order. You know, Christianity is a personal relationship between the individual and God with Christ as the intercessor. And Judaism is a covenant between God and this very small group of people who exist in this tiny little speck of land. It's not calling for ruling anyone in the world. Everyone is, if anything, they promote the individual under God, and God is the sovereign, not some earthly, you know, order. So Islam, in that sense, is a departure from that. And in a way, it could be viewed in the same category as these secular faiths that I mentioned, namely communism and Nazism. Now, Robert, you mentioned in the press release here that I'm looking at, that you feel that radical Islam is on the rise under Biden. And now I'm in Boston. We just had this incident a few days ago where this militia, whatever, was pulled over on the side of the highway in Wakefield, which is a suburb of Boston. And they called themselves the Moors, and that they were fully armed. They were in military fatigues. Nobody quite knows what they were doing. They don't recognize the US government. They didn't have licenses either to have firearms or even to drive. And they're now being questioned in court as I speak. And I think that it's safe to say that they're Muslims. They were part of this Moorish group, really. Well, maybe like Nation of Islam. I don't know. But what do you know more about that?
Nation of Islam actually comes from the group that they're part of. The people who did this in Massachusetts, had this armed standoff with police, are part of what is known as the Moorish Science Temple of America, which was founded around 1913 by a Black American named Noble Drew Ali. That's what he called himself. His original name was Timothy Drew. And Noble Drew Ali put together what he called the Quran of the Moorish Science Temple, which is not the Quran of Islam. It's an amalgamation of some esoteric spirituality, the Rosicrucians, and things like that, put together with his own writings. And the Moorish Science Temple has a lot of the same kind of racial theories that the Nation of Islam has. The Nation of Islam is actually a breakaway group from the Moorish Science Temple. The Moorish Science Temple reveres Noble Drew Ali as a prophet. And that in itself, along with their Quran that's not the real Quran, makes them not people that would be recognized as Muslims by any Muslim group in the world. However, they consider themselves to be Muslims. And that's where I hope law enforcement authorities are studying what they think about jihad and trying to understand whether they think they need to wage war against unbelievers. And that would be something that our intelligence office officials ought to be doing if they weren't chasing imaginary white supremacists.
Right, exactly. They're busy chasing people who might have trespassed at the U.S. Capitol, and you know they're arresting the national sweep of that, versus genuine threats to public safety. These people, I think it's safe to say, they're black supremacists, in the same way that maybe some real fringy Christian identity groups might be white supremacists, in that they're working these, the crackpot race theories into their religion. Those have nothing to do with Judaism. I don't think they have anything, well, Christianity, and I actually don't think it has to do with Islam either. I don't think Islam is supremacist in terms of racially.
No, not at all. It's supremacist for Arabs. Witness the fact that converts to Islam around the world, no matter what their ethnicity is, they take an Arabic name. Like Cassius Clay becomes Muhammad Ali, and Lew Alcindor, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and so on. And of course, if you convert to Islam, no matter what language you speak, you have to pray in the mosque in Arabic and read the Quran.
Arabic is the sacred language, in the way that Hebrew might be the sacred language in Judaism, and then Latin is the sacred language in Catholicism. I don't know.
Would it be possible to be Jewish without knowing Hebrew?
Yeah, of course, but you do pray in Hebrew when you go to the
very synagogue. Difficult to be a Muslim without having at least some knowledge of Arabic, although to be sure, the madrasas in Pakistan, the boys there memorize the whole Quran without knowing what it means at all. They're just memorizing a lot
Hebrew
of
school. I mean, you have that among some ultra-Orthodox Jews will learn Hebrew, and even I think Greek Orthodox have Greek as a holy language in liturgically speaking. So, but Robert, you say that you think there's going to be an increase in Islamic terror under Biden. Talk about that a little bit.
That's just basically strength versus weakness, that Islamic jihadis work on the basis of power, and they understand strength and weakness. They understand the world in terms of strength and weakness. They see the Biden administration as weak, where they saw the Trump administration as strong. They saw the Obama administration as weak. Right or wrong, this is how they saw it. And so we had the Fort Hood jihad attack, the San Bernardino jihad attack, the Boston Marathon jihad attack, Chattanooga, so many others during the Obama administration. Trump administration, we didn't see this kind of thing. And now Biden is president, and we had the attack that you mentioned in Boston, and there have been others also.
Right. Okay. So that's troubling. And certainly under Trump, there was peace breaking out of the Middle East. You had the Abraham Accords. You had a complete drop in terrorism and violence. And now it's all on the upswing. So it's very, very troubling. All right, Robert Spencer, let my viewers and listeners know where they can get your excellent book and any other information.
Yeah, Did Muhammad Exist? Revised and Expanded Edition is available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and anywhere that you have a brick and mortar bookstore. If they don't have it, ask them to order it. And I'm at jihadwatch.org online and jihadwatchrs on Twitter.
All right, Robert Spencer. Listen, I want to thank you for joining me today. Pleasure as always.
Yeah, likewise, Charles. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Too.
All right. Bye-bye. Okay. So that's Robert Spencer. you're certainly welcome. I'm going to stay on a little bit longer to take calls. His book, again, is Did Muhammad Exist? An Inquiry into Islam's Obscure Origins. You're welcome to join the program here. I'll just keep up a little bit longer to see if anyone would like to chime in. 617-396-4958. 617-396-4958. A lot covered there. Interesting topic, of course. I thought it was interesting how he noted toward the end that if you have a strong administration that supports America first, both domestically and around the world, then you have peace. Reagan talked about this, peace through strength. President Trump was the epitome of this. And now, of course, we don't have that. And we're in a dangerous time, unfortunately. I'll be back at 2 to talk to my next guest, that being Christopher Abt. We're going to be talking about the Supreme Court decision that returns to the states the right to regulate their respective elections. Check out my books, particularly my new book, The Satanic Conspiracy, available at Amazon Books. Just go to the server, put my name in the server, Charles Moskowitz. That's Moscow, like the city, Witz. It's a phonetic. It actually means son of Moses. And you will find The Satanic Conspiracy. So check it out and check out my new website, charlesmoskowitz.com, where I list up to 30 different venues that carry the program. And on that note, I want to thank you all for joining me this afternoon. God bless you all. God bless America.